3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respects to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning. Today you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, the 28th of July, 2026. Thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. I'm in the studio here with Julia.
Hey.
And my name is Elena. Yeah, we had a bit of a quick jump in this morning. Nice to see you.
It was definitely a jump in, but we're here. We made it. It's nice to see you, though.
Yeah, it's been a while.
I know. Yes, you were traveling.
I was.
Yeah, how'd it go? Did you have
went so well. Been so That's busy good. Since I've been back. But how are you? What have you been up
to?
Yeah,
not too bad. I'm just trying to get through all the cold weather and avoid it as much as possible.
Yep.
Which can be hard. Yeah. But we're getting there. Midway through, I think.
We can both be FISA this morning and talk about the weather.
Yes, it's the best topic. We're also weather reporters.
Yeah, exactly. But anything exciting coming up for you? In this next week?
Well, honestly, not like the most exciting things, but I know you have something exciting tomorrow. Do you want to, tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm doing my first ever solo exhibition at
amazing.
Wheat, Wine and Whiskey, which is like a gastropub and venue in Collingwood on Smith Street. And I think it'll be a lot of fun. It's
oh
a little
gosh,
scary.
That's
but
so exciting. And these so they're paintings that you've done?
Yeah, mostly paintings. There is a room, so it's two floors and then like a little back room area. So most of it is paintings, and then just in that one little back room I have a couple prints, I think 9 prints. But yeah, pretty big collection.
That's so cool. I really want to see them. So is it just tomorrow night or
tomorrow night is the opening, so that's the most important night. But yeah, the show will be on until the end of October.
Ah, awesome. Yep. Okay. So there's time to see it.
There is.
Well, in case I can't come tomorrow, but I might. Yeah. That's so cool. How long did the paintings take you?
Some of them, I have a couple of them that are pretty old paintings. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them, I just got this opportunity right before I went traveling. So a lot of them I finished in 10 days.
Wow.
I think there was 9 paintings that I did in 10 days.
Oh my gosh.
Which was crazy.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations. I'm excited to see it.
Well, thank you. Got a pretty packed show coming up. At 7:15, we've got Jaina Favero, the Deputy CEO and Head of Systemic Change at the Asylum Seeker Resource Center, who recently spoke at the Justice for Chimani rally that was held on the 19th of July. And then at 7:25, we have Juliet Fox celebrating Earth Matters' 30th anniversary from Sunday, July 26th, a conversation between Claudia and Juliet, the founder and inaugural presenter and producer of Earth Matters. And they reflect on the program and talk about these last 3 decades. At 7:45, we'll be speaking to Emily Owens, who is the Australian Education Union sub-branch president at Parkville College, and we will be discussing education of people in youth justice facilities and the discrepancies with the Victorian government on funding for that kind of thing.
And then at 8 a.m., we will be speaking with Freya Dinshaw, who is an associate legal director from the Human Rights Law Center, who will be speaking to us about the recently strengthened modern slavery laws in Australia.
And at 8:15, we'll be speaking to Bridget with The Torch, which is a Melbourne-based First Peoples-led organization that runs art programs and all of their art sales to support Indigenous Australians in or recently released from Victorian prisons. And we'll be speaking about the fundraiser that they are holding on August 30th. But for now, headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty. Now one, two, nitty gritty. Now yeah, boom, nitty gritty.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 28th of July, 2026. Aboriginal leaders have warned the Northern Territory's controversial overhaul of child protection laws could embolden other governments to weaken protections for First Nations children after the legislation passed Parliament despite sustained opposition from Indigenous organisations and child welfare experts. National Commissioner for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children and Young People, Wurundjeri and Ngari Iliam Wurrung woman, Professor Sue Ann Hunter said communities across Australia should pay close attention to the reforms. The Care and Protection of Children Legislation Amendment, Every Child Matters Bill 2026, passed the Legislative Assembly last Tuesday, marking the most significant overhaul of the territory's child protection system in decades. Among its most contentious changes is the removal of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Child Placement Principle as the paramount consideration in placement decisions involving Aboriginal children. Developed in response to the Bringing Them Home report into the Stolen Generations, the principle seeks to ensure Aboriginal children remain connected to their family, community and culture wherever it is safe to do so. In other news, Israeli soldiers have intensified their offensive in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, raiding at least 20 towns and villages, demolishing homes and arresting dozens of Palestinians as Arab states and the Arab League condemn escalating settler attacks against Palestinians and their property. Al Jazeera reporters in the occupied West Bank reported on Monday that Israeli forces had stormed the Jabal Salman area in the town of Beita, south of Nablus, and carried out demolition operations in the town of Nilan, west of Ramallah. In a separate incursion, forces stormed the town of Arabe in Jenin, occupied by military bulldozers. Settler violence continues to escalate across the occupied West Bank with the direct assistance of the Israeli military. In the last few days, violent settlers attempted to burn Palestinian families alive in their homes and established four new illegal outposts. The IOF blocked ambulances attending to injured Palestinians and attacked journalists, medics with gas canisters. Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories, has described these attacks across the West Bank as pogroms and called for an immediate arms embargo on Israel. Here in Naam, a rally has been called this Sunday at 12 p.m. at the State Library, Victoria.
Also in the news, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that the following headline mentions the name of an Indigenous person who has died. More than a year after the death of 24-year-old Walpuri man Kumaji White and his family have commenced proceedings in the Northern Territory Supreme Court to obtain answers about the decision not to prosecute the police officer involved in his death. His family announced the decision in a media statement released yesterday. The Walpuri man died after being restrained by two police officers in a Coles supermarket in Alice Springs in May 2025. On the eve of the first anniversary of his death, while many of the family was gathered in Lajamaju for sorry business, representatives of the Northern Territory of Public Prosecutions and Northern Territory Police traveled to the community and informed the family that no charges will be laid. The family was not given any reasons for the decision, nor who made it. Ned Jumpinja Hargraves, speaking on behalf of the family, said, "Our people have been raising concerns about police investigating police for decades. We say that from day one we did not trust this process. Now the authorities keep pointing at each other and none will take any responsibility or speak straight to us. Kumanji was my Jaja and his wife was life was violently cut short. We deserve to know all the information about his death and about the process, including who decided that no one should be charged and why." Finally, in the headlines, Parents for Climate welcomes the federal government's decision to close the Climate Active program, and at the end of a risky practice of certifying businesses' voluntary climate claims as carbon neutral. The National Parent Advocacy Organization that has campaigned for over 3 years through a landmark court case, community advocacy, and an investigation into greenwashing by energy companies. In a consultation paper released this week, the Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment, and Water confirmed the government has decided to close the Climate Active and cease certifying voluntary carbon neutral claims. The paper affirms the arguments for change made by Parents for Climate, pointing to the declining public trust in the term carbon neutral, rising greenwashing litigation, and a clear shift towards direct emissions reduction. It marks the end of a federal scheme that until now allowed companies to market fossil fuel products as carbon neutral on the strength of carbon offsets. Parents for Climate Nonsense report last year found that more than one in three of Australia's major energy retailers at risk of misleading customers with carbon neutral and offset claims, many of them pointing to Climate Active certification to justify the marketing. These have been the news headlines of Tuesday, the 28th of July, 2026. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you are currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Trans Family is a not-for-profit organization providing a peer support group for loved ones, including parents, siblings, extended family, and friends of a trans and gender diverse person. Trans Family runs discussion groups in person and online. We offer a safe space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your situation, and provide peer support. We are especially keen to hear from loved ones in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to Trans Family are tax deductible. For more information, visit transfamily.org.au or look for us on Facebook. Trans Family is a 3CR supporter.
Do you work in a brothel, massage shop, escort agency, fetish house or dungeon, cam studio or porn set, sauna, short-time hotel, outdoors or on the street, or in any other space where sex work happens? Recent changes to Victorian sex work laws mean that sex workers now have more options for how and where we can work and who we can work with.
To find out more about Victoria's new sex work laws, contact Vixen, Victoria's statewide peer-only sex work organisation, 100% by and for all sex workers on 039-070-9050.
And talk to another sex worker about what the partial decriminalisation of sex work means for you, your workplace and your community. Or check out the Decrim Info Hub at vixen.org.au. Vixen is a 3CR supporter.
Jana Favero is the Deputy CEO and Head of Systemic Change at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, ASRC, and recently spoke at the Justice for Chimani rally that was held on the 19th of July 2026 outside the State Library and organised by Tamil Ilam Solidarity. Tamil Ilam Solidarity is calling on the Australian government and the international community to act urgently following the discovery of hundreds of bodies in the Chimani mass grave and other mass grave sites across the Tamil homeland. More than 400 human remains have now been uncovered at Chimani, with excavations continuing. For many Tamil families, these graves are believed to hold loved ones who were forcibly disappeared during the 1990s and the final years of the armed conflict. Tamil Ilam Solidarity is calling on the United Nations to establish an independent international investigation into the Chimani mass grave and other mass grave sites across the Tamil homeland. The organisation is also calling for those responsible for war crimes and crimes against humanity to be brought before international justice mechanisms for accountability for the atrocities committed against the Tamil people. Here is Jana Favero.
I would like to invite our second speaker. Jana Favero is the Deputy CEO and Head of Systemic Change at ASRC. During the 100-day refugee protest in Melbourne, Jana, alongside ASRC founder Con, stood beside us. They provided practical support, resources, and solidarity when it mattered most. That support helped thousands of refugees finally secure their permanent visas after years of uncertainty. Please welcome Jana.
Thank you. I'd also like to acknowledge that we are here on stolen land. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. The Asylum Seeker Resource Centre joins the calls in Justice for Chimani as we watch on with horror at the atrocities that are happening at the moment around the world, whether it's in Gaza or Sudan or Yemen. We also need to remember the atrocities that have happened to the Tamil people, to the genocides that happened, the decades of targeted persecution and only, you know, uncovering all of those injustices and the mass graves. It's time for the international community to stand up, and the community in Australia as well. At ASRC, we have seen so many people over the past 25 years since we started who are Tamils who have fled persecution from Sri Lanka. And we are not all free and safe till everyone is free and safe. And the international community absolutely has a responsibility, and we need to be watching what is happening currently in Sri Lanka, but also what had happened previously, and in solidarity with Tamil people, is have an independent investigation into what is happening. We cannot trust those in power, especially those in power currently who have been complicit in genocide previously of Tamil people, targeted towards Tamil people. I can speak out in safety. It's my responsibility to speak out. I'm safe, but many others aren't. We also know the intergenerational trauma on families when they haven't had proper burials. There's been no recognition, there's been no acknowledgement of the injustices that have happened. So Justice for Chimani is not only about the injustices of the past, but making sure that it never happens again, and those who are responsible are held to account. That is such an important part of this, because there's only justice if there is persecution, and those who are responsible are never, ever, ever able to inflict such death and suffering on tens of thousands of families. I mean, it's been recognised that the mass disappearances of the Tamils are some of the largest that we've ever seen in history. So ASRC will continue to turn up in solidarity, to use our voice for justice for Chemeni and for all Tamil people. And so justice for Chemeni. Thank you.
Thank you, Jana. We really appreciate your solidarity. Thank you.
That was Jana Favero, Deputy CEO and Head of Systemic Change at the ASRC, speaking at the recently held Justice for Chemeni rally that took place on the 19th of July 2026. Thank you to Jordan for recording this event. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM. Next up, we're going to be playing a song by Spinifex Gum. It is called Dream Baby Dream.
We got it.
3CR's Earth Matters celebrated its 30th anniversary on Sunday, the 26th of July. And to mark this milestone, Claudia spoke to founder and inaugural presenter slash producer and now projects coordinator at 3CR, Juliet Fox, about what she remembers from her first show, as well as the role the program has played in the broader environmental movement across the last 30 years. For some context, in the first episode of Earth Matters, Juliet boarded the Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior 2 and spoke to Captain Derek Nichols. She also spoke to Murundu Yana, then CEO of the Carpentaria Land Council, about the CRA RTZ Century Zinc Mine in Queensland. Here's Claudia and Juliet reflecting on 30 years of Earth Matters.
Listening back to that first episode, what do you remember about that first show?
I don't remember a huge amount about going and visiting that boat. I know that I really liked doing things like that, going out and actually recording things on site. And I certainly, in listening back to Murundu Yana from the Carpentaria Land Council at that time, I had interviewed him on a number of occasions before that. And I'm sure you would agree he was, you know, a very radical voice at that time and continued to be a very staunch black man talking about protecting his country up in the northwest of Queensland. And I know that at the time I was conscious of what he was saying and the line that exists in terms of potential defamation and other potential legal things, because he was not holding back, as you would have heard. And I had, you know, had him live on air on other shows that I had been doing at the time. And I do recall a 3CR staff person coming into the studio afterwards and going, are you sure that was okay, what he was saying? Because he was calling people murderers and he was calling people corrupt and liars and racists and all of the things. And yes, I certainly remember being conscious of that, but also confident that what he was saying was based in truth, and he was providing lots of evidence of his personal experience of being, you know, trying to protect country against a multinational mining company. And again, in listening back to it, made me think, you know, I doubt that he had that kind of a run on any other media outlet. He was certainly in the media in different ways, but they would not have, I think, allowed him to say all of the things that he was saying. And I think at that time, you know, it's the mid-90s, at that time in the environment movement, and I think there are still struggles going on today to really focus on First Nations priorities and voices and make sure that people are attuned to some of the wishes of traditional owners, so-called, in various areas. And I think that I was definitely conscious of making sure I was giving voice, I don't always love that term, to First Nations voices on environmental issues. And I think that in the wider movement, that wasn't widely adhered to. I think it's definitely more present now, but 30 years ago, that was probably more definitely on the progressive end.
Juliet Fox there, the founder and first presenter of Earth Matters, sharing her reflections 30 years on from the inaugural show. Let's hear some more. So what was happening then in the Australian environmental movement?
Yeah, 1996, I would say it was pretty active. I was certainly pretty active within various spaces. There was a lot of grassroots campaigning happening in Melbourne on all sorts of different issues, whether they were against uranium mining or for the protection of old growth forests around Australia. Yeah, I think that there was a lot of different community groups working, even very close to here, if I'm thinking of down the road at Friends of the Earth or in town at the Wilderness Society. So I think that there was a lot of awareness of looming issues like climate change or global warming, as we were probably calling it back then, and a lot of activity. I suppose I was a relatively young person at the time and certainly, you know, was part of a big group of friends who were all active in different ways on different environmental issues.
You mentioned climate science. My recollection was there was a fair bit of scepticism back then and for quite a while afterwards. How did that impact things?
Definitely. I think it was a key example of a space like community radio taking on an issue that was quite marginalised, maybe considered quite alternative, but also taking it seriously and having good conversations around what might be going on there. And I think that, you know, obviously it's 30 years ago, but even at the time, you know, the prospect that humanity's industrial activities weren't having some kind of significant impact on the health of the environment, I mean, that as a concept is not particularly wild or outrageous, and the prospect that humanity should do something about that to protect the natural environment and be cautious and take initiatives to protect was, yes, in some spaces considered radical or weird or unproven, but I think in the wider grassroots movement and in the alternative media scene, it was common sense, really, to go, well, industrialization is having a massive impact and the trajectory of this is looking bad. We need to be cautious and we need to do something about it now, sadly.
Mm.
Well, it's really, you know, in reflecting, I suppose, as we are here doing today, in reflecting on 30 years of really inaction in lots of different ways, whether it is around the logging of old growth forests or just action on mitigating against climate change, it's just horrendous, actually, to look back over those 30 years and consider what could have been done if people had heeded the warnings and looked at the science and considered things in a reasonable way. But instead, I would say that capitalism overrode a lot of clear thinking and continues to, and we continue to see profits put first over the protection of the environment and the wellness of communities around the world.
And you mentioned sending faxes back then. I was thinking this was a pre-digital era. How did that impact the way you went about making radio and doing the work behind the scenes?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that program, the first program that was done on a reel-to-reel, listening to the edits that are done in there, did make me flinch at various moments and think about the smooth ways that that could be done now. But the challenges that are doing things on reel-to-reels required. And yes, you know, so I would have gone out to do that visit on the Rainbow Warrior with a Tascam, which was the portable recorder of the time, a bit of a hefty thing, weighty thing over the shoulder that was recording straight onto a cassette. And so then you'd bring the cassette back and dub it onto a reel-to-reel and then do your editing that way. So, yes, I think there's been a huge amount of change behind the scenes in radio. But then when you think about people consuming radio, yes, again, they consume it in different ways, but it's still that intimate listening experience that actually hasn't really changed.
And what were your aspirations for the program at that point? You launched it as a national program, which was a pretty big step in itself. What was your vision?
I think I was very focused on sharing information and the importance of communication and communication/education in terms of activating communities to do good things. So to my mind, this was a very important tool, as is community rodeo more broadly, to educate and activate communities to protect the environment, for, again, want of a better word. So, yeah, I was keen to get the word out, whether it was about the different campaigns and issues that the show covered, whether it was about encouraging people to do things, and obviously having it as a national platform was really exciting, because there's lots and lots of stations around Australia that could take the show and play it on their station. So I was, again, aware of that and making sure that the show as it is now is very national in its focus. I was keen to educate, to agitate to a certain degree, and to get information out to people so that they would be more active.
How do you feel now then that the show has sustained itself and continued for 30 years? What does that feel like?
Oh, I think it's fantastic that the show has continued, and obviously I started it and so many people have been part of it over the decades, and hopefully they've all got lots out of it and continue to get lots out of it as well. I think it's, on the one hand, it's great that it, you know, still exists and plays such a pivotal role, and then on the other hand, I'm sometimes surprised at how it's still filling such a gap. You know, actually at the time when it started, Radio National, for example, did have a dedicated half-hour environment show. It doesn't anymore. And so the gap that shows like Earth Matters still play in providing information around environmental campaigns and then that drive to action that's pushed out to the community. Sure, there's lots of things going on social media and other digital platforms, but that kind of long form of hearing directly from campaigners or people on the ground in different situations, Earth Matters is really the key one that's still doing that in terms of a national dedicated environment show. It's a safe space, if you like, for campaigners to come on and know that they're not going to be challenged by some stupid question, and that they are going to, yeah, be able to have their say and get their message out. And I think a lot of organisations still would consider Earth Matters somewhere where they could come and go, hey, can I come on and talk about this? And that's fantastic.
That was a conversation between Claudia and Juliet Fox, founder and inaugural presenter / producer of Earth Matters, as they reflect on the impact of the program in the last 3 decades. Earth Matters shares local and global environmental issues from grassroots activist perspectives with a strong social justice focus. Tune in every Sunday at 11 a.m. till 11:30 a.m. or go to 3cr.org.au/earthmatters.
Up next, we'll be listening to a song. This is Spinning Around by Kylie Minogue. This morning, we will be speaking to Emily Owens, the Australian Education Union sub-branch president at Parkville College. Parkville College is a specialist government Victorian school that provides tailored year-round education to vulnerable young people detained in youth justice, custodial facilities, or secure care settings. Today, we will be discussing the ways in which incarcerated youth access to education, the specific frameworks of Parkville College, and how gaps in funding from the Victorian government affect both staff and students. For anyone who may find this content confronting, contact 13 Yarn 139276, a 24/7 free confidential crisis support line run by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, or contact Lifeline at 131114. Thanks for coming on the show, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
How are you this morning?
I'm well, thank you. Yep. Ready for another day at work?
Yes, I heard it's never a bore there.
No, that's true.
Well, yeah, Parkville College isn't just like any other school in Victoria. Can you explain to our listeners what it looks like to work with students in a youth carceral space?
Yeah, sure. So, as you said in your introduction, Parkville College operates within the youth prisons here in Victoria. There's a campus at Cherry Creek and the one that I work with here at Parkville. The school started in 2013 with five teachers, wish it was five students. and over the years, that has grown to more than 130 staff. As a school, we offer a really diverse curriculum. And we have a focus on vocational subjects, so we do lots of art, music, hospitality, engineering. In terms of what school looks like, I guess, in the prisons, there are dedicated classroom spaces and learning spaces, so we've got kitchens and workshops, and education forms a really key part of the children's days. So every morning, teachers deliver a timetable of the day's classes, and you know, teachers are always planning for these for really rich learning experiences. But you can imagine that it's extremely difficult to do that in a prison setting. You know, our students are allocated education according to their residential unit, so not by their age or their ability. So, you know, one day you might have a student who's working towards a VCE subject in the same classroom that a student hasn't been to school since, you know, year six. It's really difficult to get permission to have students from one unit mixed with students from another unit. So the opportunity to build learning around students' interests and experiences is unfortunately really limited. I would say that there's a narrative around children's prisons as these kind of rehabilitative spaces, but that's simply, you know, not true. I think, you know, the other education workers in those spaces would agree with me when they say that, you know, it's really unfortunate, but schooling always comes second to security. And the fact is that, you know, there's these chronic staff shortages on the Department of Justice and, you know, what they call operational concerns, which means, you know, that kids often don't get access to classes, or they're not allowed to access the full range of subjects. I've got a good example, right, from last term. So I'm a literacy teacher, and on the unit that I teach in, of the eight classes that I had timetabled with my students over the week, only one of those classes was allocated a classroom. And that was because of security concerns with those kids accessing the program centre where the classrooms are because of issues with another unit of children. So, like, that meant effectively I'm teaching on the student's residential unit, so basically, like, bringing an English class to your living room, except that it's not your living room. It's a prison, and there's always something else happening, right? It's loud, there's no desks or chairs. You know, you're constantly interrupted.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's just not fair on the kids to expect them to learn in conditions like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, that was a long answer.
No. I mean, education in the youth justice system suffers from severe gaps and systemic hurdles or inadequate instructional time comparatively to traditional public schools. Can you speak mm-hmm. a little bit further on this issue and what this looks like for staff and students at Parkville?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, I think you will have heard, and your listeners will have heard that at the moment, teachers in Victoria are engaged in industrial negotiations for our new enterprise agreement.
Yeah.
We've been out on strike twice, and there's mounting pressure to go out again. Our schools are chronically underfunded, so that's true of public schools outside of the prison. That means that every other state in this country has locked in an agreement with federal government in a few years ago to fully fund public schools by 2034, and Victoria refused to sign that.
Yeah.
So it means that Victorian public schools are only getting 86% of their funding, and it means that by 2034, we'll have been shortchanged by almost $2.4 billion, which is really laughable considering that Victoria calls itself the education state.
Yeah.
I'm always at pains to point out that this comes at the same time this government has announced, $1.6 billion towards funding in the last two budgets. And they've also reopened a children's prison that they closed in 2023, mm-hmm. and that's cost them many hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's so skewed, right? They'd rather lock kids up than keep them in the classroom.
Yeah,
I guess in terms of the impacts of this under resourcing on children that we work with at Parkville, all of the kids that we work with there have experienced disconnection or exclusion from school and education.
Absolutely.
There was a recent Victorian Ombudsman's report into school expulsions, and that showed that around 60% of young people in the prison system had previously been suspended or expelled from school. So, people talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, and that's real.
Yeah.
And I think, look, there are many reasons for that, but one of the most common ones that I sort of have encountered is kids feeling alienated from mainstream school settings. In my own research about the educational experiences of incarcerated girls in particular, I heard stories of school exclusion that they start in primary school. So, I met one student who had been to seven different schools before she was 10.
Yeah.
And these are kids who have been suspended and excluded for things that, with the right support, with schools that are properly resourced, they could have been understood and worked through, rather than being kicked out of the system entirely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also going back to that point of, around 60% of Victoria's persistent youth offenders experiencing chronic school absence prior to, contact with the justice system. Can you discuss the unique teaching model that's practiced within Parkville College and how it's used to encourage student agency and determination?
Yes, certainly. So over the years since 2013, Parkville College developed what we call the Parkville College model. It's available online. Everybody can access it. That is really based in the idea that we're building critically conscious, independent learners. And the model is grounded in culturally responsive practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it, as you say, encourages agency for students who often in their educational experience have had none. We sort of pride ourselves on that model, but I think it's also really worth mentioning that as well as the teaching staff that we have in the school, we have a lot of wraparound services for our students. We have an amazing cultural education team that do an incredible job of holding space for the communities in our school who are subject to mass incarceration. We've also got a dedicated transitions team who work with students on plans for their pathways after prison. and a work and industry team, and they work alongside the students as they leave prison and enter the workforce. I'd probably also say that I think it's worth being honest about the fact that there has been, you know, some leadership shifting priorities at Parkville College over the past 2 years. So, you know, while that model is rooted in relational practice, there has been a shift towards, you know, I think this has been not necessarily, you know, there's been a lot of pressure to align with Department of Education and Department of Justice priorities,
yeah.
which, you know, as you can imagine, really don't always sit comfortably alongside the kind of, you know, genuine, caring, culturally safe, you know, priority that we put on relationship.
Absolutely, especially with those working in the Department of Education or in the justice system being a bit removed from being actually inside and interacting with these kids. And I think that also definitely affects the way that their legislation impacts specifically Parkville or any of these institutions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. I'm excited to get you back on next week to talk a little bit more about the teachers' strike across the state. That was last Thursday to demand better conditions. And yeah, we'll discuss after the AEU council meeting. But just as a final wrap up, what are teachers and school staff looking for in these negotiations with the Victorian government?
Sure. Look, We're looking for basic conditions that are going to make education a sustainable, appealing career, right? Some of our headline, I guess, demands that haven't been met yet are, you know, a 35% pay increase over 3 years.
Mm.
And, like, that might sound big, but it barely covers inflation. And, you know, it might not even do that.
Yeah.
We're fighting for a fair deal for education support staff who do crucial work every day. Without them, schools simply wouldn't function. They are working at the moment without a paid lunch break, and that key claim has not been addressed in our latest offer.
Mm.
We also want reduced class sizes and an enforceable cap on class sizes so that gives education workers the capacity to work with their students in really meaningful ways, just like we know from the work that we do at Parkville work.
Yeah.
I guess I'd just end on saying that, you know, I'm so proud to be part of the Parkville College sub-branch. You know, we're staunch and we're strong. And, you know, we've been out on the streets twice already and we'll go again. The messages, I guess, that we carry on our placards, and I think it sums it up really well, are education, not incarceration, teacher yeah. wages, not kids in cages, and fund schools, not prisons.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for speaking on this morning. I think it's really important to get this information out, especially for those who don't really understand what's going on and how important education is in these settings.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. I'm always happy to talk about these things because, as you say, I think they're deliberately hidden.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll talk to you next week. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. See ya.
That was Emily Owens, the sub-branch president of the Australian Education Union at Parkville College. This morning, we discussed how incarcerated youth access to education in prisons. We also spoke about how under-resourcing by the Victorian government affects both staff and students that work at the school.
Next up, we have a song by Akufa Akusa, who was a pivotal figure in the development of Togolese music. This is her song, Dandu Kojo.
Dandu kojo lo
Freya Dinshaw is an associate legal director from the Human Rights Law Center, where she specializes in corporate accountability. I recently interviewed Freya about the modern slavery laws, which were announced in Australia back in 2018, but have recently strengthened by introducing criminal punishment, holding those who violate the laws accountable. This is in order to prevent labour that violates human rights within the supply chain by preventing Australian traders from utilising it. Take a listen.
So Australia's had modern slavery laws in place for quite some time now, about 7 or 8 years, but they've been widely criticised as being very light touch and quite weak. So what our current modern slavery laws do is that they require large companies to report on their risks of modern slavery, but there's no penalties for not complying. And so, and there's no requirement for companies to actually act to address any risks that they find or to identify them in the first place. So if you don't put a statement in, or you put a misleading statement, or you have a statement that says we have forced labour but we're not addressing that, there's currently no real consequences. But just earlier this month, the Attorney General Michelle Rowland announced major reforms to the modern slavery laws. One of the key reforms proposed is that there'll be a new offence, a new criminal offence, for a failure to prevent modern slavery. What that means is that companies that have modern slavery in their supply chains, whether it's here in Australia or overseas, in circumstances where they can't show they've taken reasonable steps to prevent the modern slavery from occurring, they could be held criminally liable. So this is a really welcome development. It's very overdue. But what we hope is that it will drive real change for companies to be taking meaningful, effective action to really figure out where these risks lie and tackle them head on. And it will level the playing field so the companies that are already acting responsibly can be comfortable that that's enough to satisfy their legal obligations. But those that turn a blind eye to modern slavery will be held accountable if they fail to take that action.
Yeah, that sounds like a really positive move for business and for Australia. And seems very long overdue. I found it very interesting that as well that it seemed to be also triggered by this, what has happened with Trump as well, which I found interesting. What would your thoughts be on that, I guess?
So the Trump administration has been cracking down on the issue of forced labour in company supply chains and cracking down on countries that it thinks don't do enough to tackle forced labour. But the crackdown has coincided directly with the US Supreme Court striking down the tariffs that the administration had wanted to impose on their trading partners. So I think that many are rightly cynical about the motivation for this crackdown and, the fact that this could be seen as an alternative pathway to impose those same tariffs, but through a different means. However, regardless of the motivation, I think behind the investigations and the consequences for countries like Australia, it does expose that Australia does have a weaker approach in that regard, because many countries are now taking steps to ban goods made with forced labour. The EU has a ban, the UK is looking at it, Canada and the US have had them in place for quite some time. The longer Australia doesn't take that measure, the more likely it is that we become a kind of dumping ground for goods that are rejected from other markets because they have forced labour involved in how they're made. And it's actually estimated that $1 in every $5 that is spent on imported goods could be at risk of being connected with modern slavery, which amounts to nearly $100 billion every year that Australia is spending on potentially forced labour-made imported goods. So it's a real problem. It's growing. And while the reforms that we've introduced, I think, will go a long way to ensuring that our businesses take more responsible approaches to how they source products and services, Australia could also be looking at banning goods made with forced labour. So we have a really comprehensive world-leading approach to dealing with this problem.
Yeah, so really it's just sort of catching up with a lot of other countries and a lot of what, the rest of the world is really sort of catching up on. It sounds like definitely a good move in that direction. Another question I had was, I suppose like in a globalized world, it seems like it would be a challenge as well to ensure like that things are monitored and like ensured that this would actually be upheld? Like, what are the actions that are being, I guess there's like penalties now, criminal offences. Like, what are the measures that are going to be taken so nothing goes on behind the scenes or through loopholes? Because I know as well, I'm thinking like even online, like ordering things online, ordering things to your house, it's like, I'm curious as to how that would also be monitored.
Yeah, look, forced labour is such a pervasive practice and it's in so many different parts of the things that we buy and use every day that it is really hard for consumers to keep, I think. And so in terms of like consumers trying to shop ethically and things, I feel if you see something online that has a kind of ridiculously cheap price tag, that's one of the kind of key alarm bells to be looking a little bit further to see, to make sure that you're not supporting exploitative practices in the supply chain. But in terms of the new regime that's been proposed by the Albanese government, it's still very early days, so we're yet to see the details of how they're going to enforce it and what the offence is going to look like. But one of the things that we have been calling for quite some time is access to remedy for people who are impacted by bond slavery. So workers should be able to have a pathway to enforce their own rights where they've been in situations of forced labour and companies, you know, buying products that they've made that haven't done those proper checks and balances should be held accountable in that circumstance as well. But I think generally speaking, many countries are looking at how they address this problem in really hot, you know, like hot spots internationally. And so the more that they collaborate and share intelligence and resources to address this problem, the better supported our businesses will also be to ensure that they're sourcing ethically as well.
Yeah, definitely. That sounds like, the laws themselves are sort of like a good foundation, hopefully, for like a beginning and like movement towards that, and also changing the mind of how people, like the minds of how people shop and things. But this does go on, especially with things like that are a lot cheaper and maybe fast made, especially fast fashion, I know is a big one.
Yeah, I think that these laws definitely could have the potential to kind of impact some of those huge ultra fast fashion brands where they have like big presence in Australia. So what's proposed is that the new laws would apply to companies that have over $100 million turnover in Australia. So all of the companies that currently are meant to report would fall under the threshold of the new offence. And really what it does is like it levels the playing field. So I think the companies that kind of look to cut costs and have all of those kind of undesirable consequences attached to their model of how they make their money really will have to scrutinize their practices, because this is going to be a pretty serious new offense that means that if you're blatantly supplying from very cheap suppliers where the workers aren't being paid properly or are being held in really exploitative conditions, then that is the kind of thing that you would hope authorities would be looking into further. And I think the real benefit is that, it drives many of us to then support more like locally sustainable kind of products that you can kind of be comfortable have considered approaches to how they're produced, because ultimately, you know, none of us want to be fueling these kinds of issues. And when people are treated well in the supply chain, it kind of impacts all of us. Like it's good for society as a whole.
Yeah, definitely. It is. Yeah. And I think, a lot of people are sort of becoming more aware of, modern slavery and, the fact that it might not be happening in Australia, but doesn't mean that just because it's not happening here that we're not somehow connected is what's happening in other places.
Yeah, and actually it does happen here in Australia. I think a lot of people, when they hear the term slavery, you think it happened a long time ago, or that it happens in really like remote corners of the world. But actually it's estimated that there are more people in modern slavery today than ever before. And there's an estimated 41,000 people on any given day here in Australia that are trapped in slavery-like conditions, which is really shocking. I don't think it's what people expect.
No.
But in the region, I think like Asia Pacific has 2/3 of the forced labor cases. And so like we are very, very connected to what's happening. And there are certain kind of industries in Australia, particularly, you know, the fruit picking, cleaning, meatworks, a number of other construction is another one where there's quite high risks that there are exploited practices potentially happening. And so it's something that we need to address right here in Australia, as well as like our connection to like the global supply chains where these practices are happening as well.
Well, there you go. Exactly. Like that's even like raising awareness. Yeah, for me, I guess I never... Like, I think it's something that I would assume is always happening somewhere else, but that's so true that, yeah, it's also happening here. I think, yeah, like, what does modern slavery specifically include? Like, I know it's, like, cheap labor, forced labor, but what are the sort of, yeah, what are, like, the red, like, the what would be defined as modern slavery?
So, essentially, when we're talking about modern slavery, it's where people are trapped to do something against their will and they can't escape. And that looks different in different circumstances, but it could be being forced to work for little or no money or paying for your job, like paying all your fee, the money that you make to a recruiter who's brought you into the country to do the work, which is called debt bondage, or also if you're trafficked, if you're a child and forced into like sort of degrading work, those are all forms of modern slavery. So it's usually quite hidden, but it is increasingly pervasive, and it's a growing problem as well.
Thank you for raising awareness of this and sharing the changes that are happening, and I'm hoping that the laws, will be effective and like help prevent this from happening, and also help people realize that it is happening as well.
Yeah, thank you. We're very hopeful that this could be a pathway towards driving real change to turn this problem around here in Australia. We very much hope that the laws are passed and provide a better pathway towards a future for all those people who make the clothes that we wear and the food that we eat and the tech that we use. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
No worries. Thank you.
That was an interview with Freya Dinshaw, who is an associate legal director from the Human Rights Law Centre, who is speaking about the newly strengthened anti-modern slavery laws that hope to eradicate modern slavery from our supply chains.
We know you love listening to 3CR, but we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Save Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinina. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Dja Dja Wrong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
The Torch is a Melbourne-based First Peoples-led arts organisation that runs art programmes and sales to support Indigenous Australians in and recently released from Victorian prisons. On August 30th, a fundraiser will be held at Bar Flippies in Brunswick from 5 to 9pm. Today we will be speaking to Bridget in regards to the fundraiser and what to expect. Welcome, Bridget.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I hope your morning is going well. For those who don't already know, could you explain a little bit about what The Torch is and what they do?
Yeah, so they're based in Carlton, which is really cool because they're so local, and they work in Victorian prisons, both in prison and then also in community with First Nations people in basically supporting art industry experience and the creation of art as a way to connect to cultural understanding and history, and using this cultural connection to support reintegration into the community and minimize recidivism.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a super cool concept. Every year, The Torch works with artists from approximately 80 different cultural language groups within Victorian prisons and throughout the community. What is the importance of this work within Indigenous communities?
I think they've come across a really, important gap in our criminal justice system. Mm. And obviously they are tackling a trend of deep injustice, yeah, and working to fight that in ways that are actually culturally appropriate,
yeah,
and impactful long term.
Absolutely. I think also this this community really, really brings people together. I feel like art also has a way of doing that, and especially with like creative expression and that kind of thing is really important for people who may feel disconnected from their communities or are in really difficult situations. So The Torch being able to do that and bring people together in that way, I think is really cool.
Absolutely, yeah.
So The Torch is holding an arts fundraiser at Bar Flippies in Brunswick in late August. Why did you guys choose this venue?
So Flippies are really cool. They actually have a setup going where you can ask to host a fundraiser there and they will do it for free and they will support those events if, wow, it's something that aligns with what they, support.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we were lucky enough to come across another fundraiser that had been hosted there. And then came across the fact that they do this, which is just, such a lovely way of building community and, yeah, supporting people to do cool things.
Yeah, that's super cool. And I think, that's a good, really great venue, especially location also in Brunswick, which can be a very, creative focused area. And I think that, will bring people in, not only because they know the cause and want to support the cause, but even people just walking down the street saying, hey, I know this place, let's see what's going on.
Definitely. And we're trying to, most of the, people at this event will be local and the work will be created by local people. So having it there is sort of a really nice part of that as well.
Yeah, that's really cool. This fundraiser is all about the arts. Can you tell listeners what they can expect when they come on the day?
Yeah, so we've got a variety of local artists who are going to donate their work to be sold with all the profits going to The Torch. There's going to be a real mix. So we've got some people doing photography, a lot of printing, so lino printing, painting, drawing. There'll be quite a variety, some sewing as well. We've got people doing more sort of crafty things. It's all a little bit, I can't give everything away, but there'll be a little bit of something for everyone, hopefully. And we're aiming to sell things which are, more affordable, because obviously The Torch, you can buy artwork from their programs directly on their website. However, it's not always going to be the most accessible because they are beautiful, large artworks, whereas this is aiming to put out things that are a little bit more affordable on, the everyday.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think, having art be accessible can sometimes be a difficult thing to do, especially you know, as an artist, if you're trying to sell your work, like that is, you know, that is your work, and all that time and money and efforts goes into that. So it can be hard to find a balance between making it accessible, but also having that price reflect you and your work completely. So I think it's really cool that this fundraiser is all about accessibility and having people who, you know, may not have hundreds of thousands of dollars to drop on a huge fine arts painting piece, that they can come in and, you know, enjoy the arts and crafts and prints and that kind of thing.
Yeah, we're definitely hoping it'll expose, you know, a new group of people to the work that they do and draw attention to it in that way.
Yeah. Well, music and arts play such an important role in activism. How does the torch represent this?
Obviously, art is the center of their program and their practice, and they have obviously identified that it is, yeah, such a uniting force, as you were saying.
Yeah.
And I think it has a sort of facilitates passion in such a strong way, which aligns perfectly with activism.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's such an important part of expression and invoking emotion in other people as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think art is inherently political, and so I think expressing this and using that to form quite a collective, as the Torch has been doing this for a long time, I think is really powerful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And just finally, to wrap up, where can people find more information on the Torch and about this fundraiser?
Yeah, absolutely. So the main profile at the moment will be on Instagram, and the event is called wombat.artmarket. And then you can find all the details more specifically about the event, how to come and find us, how to attend. That's the place to be. We'll be putting out sort of more info over the next few weeks leading up to it. But yeah, keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on the show this morning to talk about the Torch and talk about your work within this fundraiser. I think it's going to be a really great event for some really important stuff.
Thank you so much. I'd also just like to encourage people to head to thetorch.org.au to read more about what they actually do and how you can support in other ways as well if you can't make the fundraiser. But thank you so much for having me on to talk about it.
Thank you so much. That was Bridget speaking about The Torch, a First Peoples organization that works to support Indigenous Australians in and recently released from Victorian prisons. A fundraiser will be held on August 30th at Bar Flippies in Brunswick from 5 to 9 p.m. For more information about The Torch, please visit thetorch.org.au.
DigiTube, people, place, language. Connecting stories, culture and language across Australia. Contribute your content in digitube.com.au. Sign up for a free account and select your options for streaming, download and broadcast promotion.
A 3CR supporter.
There are all kinds of reasons people end up with issues with alcohol and other drugs, and it's nothing new. Hi, I'm Professor Scott Wilson from the not-for-profit Aboriginal Drug and Alcohol Council. What always helps is to reflect on what life might be like without the substance abuse, and then take action. Step one is simple. See your GP or drug and alcohol worker and ask for help today. You can visit us at adac.org.au.
A 3CR supporter.
Keffiyehs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white keffiyeh to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to keffiyehs.org.au. That's keffiyehs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
And And now we will announce some events happening in the next week. So tonight from 5 to 9 p.m., A Night with Empower Foundation Thailand, Victoria's Peer Sex Network, is hosting Empower Foundation, Thailand's iconic sex work organization, for a one-night-only fundraiser held at 5 Merrifield Street, Brunswick, and Vic. So for more information, you can go to vixen.org.au. Also tonight at 6:30 p.m., there is a public forum on AI, capitalism and data centers. You can join this meeting that is co-hosted by the Socialist Alliance, Melbourne and Green Left organizations to discuss how we can push back against these destructive data centers and resist the corporate-driven AI push that poses a threat to workers and democratic rights. This will be held at the Kathleen Sim Library in the Multipurpose Room 2 on 251 Faraday Street in Carlton. And also tomorrow on the 20 and the 29th, from 7 to 10 p.m. at Wheat, Wine and Whiskey, you can catch Elena, our lovely host on the Tuesday Breakfast Show's art exhibition, which is called Companions. So that will be, running from 7 to 10 for the opening night tomorrow.
We have had quite a busy show this morning. Just to give you a little rundown, at 7:15, we listened to Jana Favero, which was the Deputy CEO and Head of Systemic Change at the Asylum Seeker Resource Center, who recently spoke at the Justice for Chimani rally that was held on July 19th, 2026, outside of the State Library.
And then at 7:25, we listened to Juliet Fox, on Earth Matters. Earth Matters is a 3CR show that's celebrating its 30th anniversary this Sunday. And she spoke to Claudia about Juliet about what they remember from their first show.
At 7:45, we spoke to Emily Owens, the Australian Education Union sub-branch president at Parkville College. We discussed the ways in which incarcerated youth access education, the specific frameworks of Parkville College, and how gaps in funding from the Victorian government affect both staff and students. And this is part one. Next week will be part two after the AEU council meeting about the effects of the Victorian teacher strike and how that will hopefully come to be, their needs will come to be met.
And then at 8 a.m., we listen to Freya Dinshaw, who is an associate legal director from the Human Rights Law Center, where she specializes in corporate accountability. And we spoke about the recently strengthened modern slavery laws that have been announced in Australia.
And at 8:15, we spoke to Bridget, who was telling us about a fundraiser that is held by The Torch, which is a Melbourne-based First Peoples-led arts organization that runs arts programs, and all of their art sales go to supporting Indigenous Australians, both in and recently released from Victorian prisons. This fundraiser will be held on August 30th at Bar Flippies in Brunswick from 5 to 9 p.m. And that was all we had for you today. Thank you so much listening to Tuesday Breakfast. This is 3CR at 8:55 a.m.
We know you love listening to 3CR, but we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Have a few children's picture books or footy boots that your kids have outgrown but want to find them a loving home? Well, drop them in at 3CR and put them in the Books and Boots bin. Books and Boots regularly sends pre-loved children's picture books and sports footwear to remote and regional First Nations communities and children across the country. Contact us at Books and Boots or go to the website www.booksandboots.org.au.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.